What acts of worship do you think that God desires most? What offering, what sacrifice, what gift, what service do you think He's most pleased with? Is it singing to Him from our hearts, singing praises to Him? Is it thanking Him and asking His grace and His help and prayer? Is it sharing the Lord's Supper in remembrance of Jesus? Is it putting big chunks of our money into the collection plate? Is it giving our attention to what He has to say to us in His Word? Did you know that there are other acts of worship that God desires that normally do not take place in church buildings? Hebrews 13, verse 16 says, "And do not neglect doing good and sharing, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased." The doing of good, the treatment of other people like we would want to be treated because of our trust and our reverence and our love for God, is a sacrifice, it's an offering, it's worship that pleases God. And I think that the sort of acts of worship that God most desires are those that normally take place outside of this building. Micah chapter 6, let me just read to you something here first. Micah 6 and verse 6 says, "With what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high?" In other words, what could I do that would most please, most worship God? What would mean more than anything to Him? "Shall I come to Him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil?" What a contribution that would be. Would that please Him most? "Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." And so what God wanted of the Jews most was not things that they did down at the temple. Those things were important, but what He wanted of them most was things that they had to do outside the temple at their homes and at work and the other places of their everyday lives. Jesus told the scribes and the Pharisees, Matthew 23 and verse 23, He said, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint, dill, and cumin." When it came to the temple worship and the sacrifices and the rituals and the giving, they got an A+. They tithed what they had, even down to the spices in their cupboards. But, Jesus told them, "You have neglected the weightier, the more important provisions of the law. Justice and mercy and faithfulness, these are the things that you should have done without neglecting the others." They majored in minors by their commitment to maybe what was kind of the equivalent of church attendance and the tithing and the temple worship, very committed to that, but they neglected the things that God wanted of them in their everyday lives. You know, a lot of times we talk about going to church, and we talk about, we speak of it as, "I'm going to worship. I'm going to go and do some things at church that are honoring and pleasing and glorifying to God," and that is what we do here. But do you ever think of going home in terms of, "I'm going to worship"? Or when you're going to work, "I'm going to worship," or to the Lions Club meeting, or to some other place where there's other people that "I'm going to worship"? Because in those places with other people, we have an opportunity to give to God the kind of offerings that God, I think, really desires most. And I think a big part of what we do here on Sunday mornings is to better equip us and motivate us to worship God everywhere else throughout the rest of the week. And we're going to leave here this afternoon, hopefully, to go to worship God in our homes and wherever it is that we go. We've been studying New Testament letter of Colossians, and we've come to that part of Colossians where Paul talks about the Lord's will of us in our homes and in the workplace. And I think that you could call these responsibilities major acts of worship. the things that God really, I think, desires of us most. I was going to look at both what he had to say about how we're to be in our homes and the workplace, but then I found I have too much to say about just the home, so we're just going to look at Colossians 3 and verse 18 through 21. Colossians 3, starting at verse 18. And I hope you know I'm not preaching a standard that I always live up to in my home, but I'll preach God's word, and I think I'm getting closer, but it's what we're all to strive to live up to. So number one this morning, Colossians 3:18, wives, be subject to your husbands. And that's the admonition to wives every time that you see wives specifically addressed in the New Testament. Hupo tasso in the Greek text, a compound word. Hupo means under or beneath, and tasso means to place or to arrange. And so he's saying you are to place or you are to rank yourself underneath your husband. And so he's saying you surrender your will to his. It is to be yielding, cooperative, supportive, not controlling, not demanding your way, but you prioritize his wishes in your decisions. And then this reason that he gives, verse 18, is not because he's a good husband. Although, fellas, that would certainly make it easier for our wives to do this. And it's not because he's earned it or he's worthy of it, but he says it is because it is fitting in the Lord. It is the will of the Lord for wives. Well, that's certainly unwelcome in our culture for sure, isn't it? And many women abhor the suggestion that wives should be submissive, seeing that as a chauvinistic suggestion, and as implying that women are inferior to men. But I think the command really has nothing to do with inferiority or superiority. Many of us men, we know that while we might be able to bench press more than our wife, intellectually, maybe spiritually, many of us know that we've married someone that's superior to us. And you think of like the commands to servants to be submissive to their masters and to citizens in the Bible to be submissive to the governing authorities. It doesn't mean that masters and governing authorities are always superior people. It doesn't have anything to do with that, but it has to do with the different roles that God has assigned and that he wants us to fulfill. And I don't think it was just based on first century social customs and culture. Because Paul, like in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 8 and 9, 1 Timothy 2, verse 13, where he talks about men having a leadership role and women the submissive role, he appeals to what happened back in the beginning in Genesis to substantiate that these are the roles God wants us to be in. He appeals back to what happened when God created man first. And then God said, it is not good for man to be alone. I will create for him a helper suitable for him. And taking the rib from man, he designed and he created woman to be the helper of man. And it's what he's intended from the beginning. I wanted to read to you something. Carol Mayhall, from her book, Marriage Takes More Than Love, she says, submission, how I hated that word. When it flashed into my mind, all I could conjure up was a non-entity, a nothing sort of yes woman. I didn't want to be only a reflection of another person. Yet here I was faced with the no-nonsense command of God, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, from Ephesians 5, verse 22. I had argued with God and with everyone else that this verse could not mean what it looked like on the surface, that it was surely a cultural statement that had meaning only for Bible times. My next attempt was to reconstruct the verse to read, wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands as to the Lord when they are acting like the Lord. But I knew it didn't mean that. As I searched the word that fifth year of our marriage, I had to conclude that this verse meant I was to submit myself to Jack in the same free, nothing held back way that I wanted to submit to Jesus Christ. Up to that point, I had felt that marriage was a 50-50 proposition, And if Jack would give his 50%, I would give mine. However, it seemed that frequently we would fight to determine whose turn it was to give that 50%. I had yet to learn that a happy biblical marriage is one that is 100% proposition with each partner willing to give 100%. Let's just look real quick at a great elaboration in the Bible on that command. 1 Peter 3. And start at verse 1. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1. Says, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. And one thing that I see in those verses is that a wife's responsibility to be submissive to her husband is not determined by his character. He may be disobedient to the word, but her responsibility to be submissive remains the same. And I also see there that if this kind of unselfish, admirable character on the part of a wife may touch and change the heart of a disobedient husband. And then he says in verse 3, your adornment, what you do to make yourself beautiful, must not be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. What will make you beautiful in God's sight, what will please Him more than church attendance and participation, is to adorn yourself with a gentle and quiet spirit. And when he says quiet, that doesn't mean not talkative. If it did, I think about every woman I've ever met would be in trouble. Doesn't mean not talkative. It's quiet in the sense of not self-assertive, argumentative, defiant, controlling, demanding your way. You're not one to raise your voice and demand your way, but peaceable, cooperative, tranquil, that kind of quiet. And he says that's a quality precious in the sight of God. And then in this way, he says, verse 5, in former times the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. And he gives an example, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham. You know, Abraham one day said, honey, we're moving. You mean that nice house we've been talking about across town? No, I mean like across the world to a land we've never seen before. And why are we doing that? We've got all our family here. Everything we have is here. Because God said to me, go forth from your country and from your relatives and your father's house and go to the land that I'll show you. And Sarah said, okay, dear. And Genesis 18, there's that story when Abraham, three visitors come and he goes in the tent and he tells Sarah, quickly make three big cakes of bread and get out the milk and the cheese. I'm going to go kill a calf and we're going to bring this great big feast out to these visitors. Extreme hospitality. And Sarah said, okay, dear. And Peter said, maybe instead of okay, dear, it was okay, Lord. Peter says she called him Lord. And I'm not saying, and I don't think Peter's saying, wives have to call their husband Lord. But I think he says Sarah did this as an illustration of the kind of the way that she would talk to Abraham, the kind of respectful way she would talk. And the principle is true that wives are to talk respectfully to their husbands. And then he ends by saying, and you have become her children, that is, her blessed spiritual children, if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. And I can imagine that submission to a husband could be a very scary thing for a wife. Maybe scary because of what others might say to her about if she does that, but also if she's to give control to somebody else that she feels maybe is not as adequate to handle things, that could be a very scary thing. But I hear Peter saying that you will have God's favor and God will take good care of you if you do what is right and what He calls you to do. So that's enough picking on wives. And before I get shot, we're going to move on. Colossians 3, verse 19. What will make it easy for our wives to do that very difficult thing God calls them to do? Well, he says, husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. And so the command to wives to be submissive to husbands is not permission to husbands to boss them around. Now, love means that her needs and her interests and her concerns are preeminent in your decision making. It means that you don't just operate and ask her to cooperate. You consult with her, you get her input, and her feelings and her preferences take priority over your own before you make any decision that involves her. The word there, Colossians 3, verse 19, for love is the agape word, which is, it's not the romantic kind of love that you fell into when you were dating. They had a different Greek word for that kind of love, and so that feeling that you had when you're dating, it's not, the command is not that you always have that feeling. This kind of love is a choice that you make. It's the kind of love that you can choose to have towards somebody that you don't even like. Jesus said, love your enemies, agape your enemies. It is a decision that you make that I will take care of her. Whatever it takes, whatever her needs are, I will make sure that those are met, and I will do what is best for her. There was a 40-year-old something suffering from the classic midlife crisis, and he sat down with a preacher one time to talk about his marriage problems. And finally he reached the bottom line and he said, I just don't love her anymore. And the preacher thought for a moment and then he said, well, it seems to me that you've only got one option. And he perked up and, is the preacher going to suggest divorce? Am I finally going to be free to pursue the thrilling life I've wanted? And the preacher says, same to me, your only option is repent and start loving your wife. And I think that's right. This love is a choice that God commands, and just as wives are to be submissive to their husbands, that responsibility is not determined by the character of her husband. This command to husbands to love your wives is not determined by the character of your wife or whether that the feelings are still there that you had when you were dating. Husbands, love your wives. We'll get a little elaboration on this one. Ephesians 5, verse 25 says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. And so we love our wives sacrificially and give ourselves up for her. And I think we know how to apply that. Let me know afterward if you don't know the answer to some of these questions. If you're feeling like Chinese for lunch, but your wife's feeling like Mexican, guess where you're going to lunch? If you come home from work and you're tired and you just want to turn on the TV and vegetate for a while and not talk to anybody, but your wife's really needing to talk to somebody and she's really craving some adult interaction, guess what you do when you come home from work if you love her like Christ loved the church and he gave himself up for her? If the kid or the dog makes a mess and somebody's got to clean it up, guess who hops up to clean it up if you give yourself up for her? If you've saved up enough money for a new hunting rifle, but you know the washing machine has been giving the wife's fits and she's frustrated with the thing every day, guess what you buy for your wife if you love her like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her? Maybe you're not a touchy-feely PDA kind of person, but if your wife just really likes it, if you just hold her hand when you walk together, guess how you walk through the store and the mall and wherever. If you love her like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. A little more elaboration, Ephesians 5 and verse 28, he says, you husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. And then in the next verse, he mentions how we nourish and we cherish our bodies. And those terms, nourish and cherish, refer to when you don't just keep something alive, but you take care of it in a way that it thrives and it's comfortable and it's mint condition. We don't just keep our bodies alive, do we? We make sure that they're well fed and rested, and we dress them in warm, comfortable clothes. And we don't want our bodies to experience any unnecessary pain or discomfort. And so we sit them on cushions. We adjust the thermostat so it's just right for our bodies. If we have any backache or anything, we take ibuprofen. If there's a weird growth or a spot or something, we take it to the doctor. You know, we're very good. We don't just give them our bodies their needs, but all the extras. It just make them as comfortable and happy as can be. And he says, you love your wife like this. And so we see to it that all of her needs, physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever they are met, whatever that takes, that she's not experiencing any pain emotionally, physically, that she doesn't need to be feeling. We nourish and cherish her. And then in our text in Colossians 3:19, he adds, and do not, literally, if you translated it literally, and do not be bitter toward them. You might have, and do not be harsh with them, but literally just do not be bitter toward them. And it's a word that refers to being like you have a sour or bitter taste in your mouth. So, you know, we call our wives honey and sweetie and sugar and gumdrop and cupcake. And our tone of voice and how we speak to her and how we treat her should be like she brings that sweet taste to our mouth, not like she's vinegar or cough syrup or something like that. Don't be bitter toward her like you have that taste in your mouth. What does that mean? Ephesians 4:31, you have the same word, bitterness. And I think you have some expressions of what it would be to be bitter, to be bitter towards someone. Ephesians 4:31, he says, let all bitterness, and then he says, and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you. And I think all those would be expressions of bitterness. Wrath is the outbursts of anger, and the word anger is more the settled, abiding kind of anger you don't let go of. Clamor is the shouting. It's like yelling in somebody's face kind of thing. And slander is just any talk that's to insult or belittle or hurt someone. So do not be bitter towards your wife. Do you ever yell at your wife? Do you ever call her names? Do you ever tell her to shut up? Do you ever push her out of your way? Do you ever say you're a pain in the neck, something like that? That would all be bitter. And Paul, as a messenger of the Lord, he just plain says, don't. Without any qualifications. Not don't if what she did was an accident or if she's apologetic, but just don't. You don't yell at your wife. You don't call her names. Anything like that. Period. Wives, be submissive to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. Don't be embittered toward them. And then real quick, talk to the children. If you're a dependent in your parents' home, Colossians 3:20 says, children, be obedient to your parents in all things. And nothing real difficult about that to understand. Hard to understand about that. All things would be when a child agrees with the parents and when he disagrees. Assuming, of course, they don't want him to do anything sinful. And the motivation is not because parents always know best, but it's the same motivation for why wives submit to husbands and husbands love their wives. And it's because it is well-pleasing to the Lord. And so disobedience to parents is disobedience to Christ for a young person. You just think about the little glimpse that we have into the adolescent years of Jesus' life in Luke chapter 2. And you know, he's 12 years old and his parents accidentally left him behind in the big city, Jerusalem. They finally found him 3 days later in the temple, sitting among the rabbis, listening to their teaching and discussing the scriptures with them. And he's amazing everybody at his understanding of God and his word and his will at such a young age. And then right after that story in Luke 2, I think it's verse 51. I'll just read it so I don't get it messed up. Luke 2:51, it says, "And he, Jesus, went down with them," his parents, "and came to Nazareth." And then just kind of a summary of his adolescent years, he says, "And he continued in subjection to them." And don't you think if there's ever a kid that did not need the guidance and the rules of a parent, it would be Jesus. He amazed people at his understanding of God and right and wrong. He was an unusually wise 12-year-old and teenager. But when Mary would holler down the street, "Jesus, come in, it's time for supper," he wasn't like the kid whose friend says, "You know, you better go, she's calling you." And he says, "Well, I don't have to go just yet, she's only called me twice." You know, Mary and Joseph just have to tell Jesus one time, and clean your room, yes ma'am. Wash the dishes, yes sir. Be home by 8, you got it. And when he said, "I'm going to go to Johnny's house," Johnny's house wasn't just the stopping off place to go where he really wanted, that he knew his parents didn't really want him to go. He continued in subjection to them, obedient in all things, and that's what a Christian young person does. And then one last thing real quick, he says something to fathers. Colossians 3:21, "And fathers, do not exasperate your children." And you might find it interesting that he just talks to the fathers and he doesn't talk to the mothers there. Why is that? I think he's talking to the fathers as the heads of their households and the ones primarily responsible for the proper raising of the kids, and the principle certainly still apply to mothers. And I find it interesting that this is all he says to fathers. I would expect maybe something like also love your kids, or like he says in Ephesians 6:4, bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. But you don't have any of that here. And it may be that Paul's assuming that these Christian fathers in Colossae, they know that, and that they love their kids, and they're trying to raise them in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And so he just gives these fathers a warning about a particular problem that dads seem to have. He says, "Do not exasperate your children." And the word means to anger, to embitter, to provoke, to stir up feelings of resentment. And I don't think he's saying never make your kids angry, because if that was the case, you'd have to do the worst thing in the world for your kids and just always let them have their way. The tense of it's a present tense, and it could be rendered, "Do not keep on exasperating," or "Do not keep on provoking to anger." And I think Paul's envisioning a situation where a father is constantly correcting and criticizing and reprimanding every little wrong or imagined wrong, that he's just always telling his kid it's just always negative, always what's wrong with them. Like the father of the little boy that went to school, you know, and they asked the little boy, "What's your name?" And he said, "Johnny Don't." That can't really be, "Well, that's what Dad always calls me." I think it's a warning not to be too strict, too critical, too hard on them. And if we're hard on them, it's probably because we love them. We want them to be the best they can be. But there's a danger. Paul says they may lose heart. In other words, I think they may feel like I can't do anything right. They will feel like I just can't make Dad happy. And they may quit trying. J.B. Phillips' paraphrase I think is good here. It says, "Fathers, do not overcorrect your children, so that they don't grow up feeling inferior and frustrated." And I think that's the idea. Just be careful. We're to discipline and instruct, but be careful that they're not discouraged. And so I think we should balance our discipline and our correction with complimenting and praising every little attempt to please and kindness that they do and bit of progress they make. And reaffirm to our kids that we love them how they are. Whether they get straight A's or they're all stars of their sport teams or they meet some high standard or not, they'll be loved by us whether they meet those standards or not. Let's go to worship this afternoon. In our homes, let's offer to God the things that He most desires. The decision to be submissive to our husbands, to selflessly love our wives, to be obedient to parents in all things, and let's encourage our kids. Let's stand together, let's sing. If we can help you obey the gospel or pray for you, please come.